Welcome to Talking Too Loud, the show that's serving up the loudest takes on building businesses, top-notch products, and unforgettable brands. I'm Chris Savage, the co-founder and CEO of Wistia, and this week we're getting loud about the psychology of marketing.
Brain science, baby.
Let's go, brain science. Because if you're a marketer and you're not thinking about how people actually make decisions, you're missing the biggest lever that you've got.
Gotta pull it.
You got to pull that lever. So today we're talking to someone who's made a career out of pulling that lever, Nancy Harhut, the co-founder and chief creative officer at HBT Marketing. Nancy specializes in using behavioral science to drive action, whether that's getting someone to click, buy, or just keep reading. So we wanted to dig into the brain shortcuts that really work, FOMO, curiosity gaps, emotional triggers, and how to use them ethically in your marketing. Nancy, thank you so much for being here. We have to start with the big idea. So you've said that people don't make decisions the way that they think they do. What do you mean by that?
Great question, Chris. So basically, you know, we all think we know exactly why we do what we do, right? If you ask me, you know, why I bought something or why I didn't buy something or, you know, why I did something, why I would tell you exactly why. And I would point to some very legitimate, you know, logical sounding reasons. And for all the world, it would seem like, yeah, that's pretty legitimate. And I would believe it. But the truth of the matter is, very often, there are other factors at play that influence people's decisions. And often, we're not even aware of them. But there are these little things that kind of put the thumb on the scale and shift us in one direction or another. And they kind of operate at a below consciousness level, because the truth is, we're so incredibly busy these days. We're running in a million different directions. So many pulls on our attention that in order for us to really make it through the day, we have to rely on these hardwired decision-making shortcuts that humans as a species have developed over the ages. And again, most of the times we're not even aware that we're doing it, but we are. And so we're cruising along on autopilot. We're making these decisions. And then if somebody kind of snaps us to and says, well, you know, Chris, why did you do that? Sylvia, why didn't you do that? You'd be like, well, here's why. And we believe what we're saying. And there is some element of truth to it, but it's not the entire story. Okay. We don't think the way we think we do. Very often we're relying on these decision defaults, these hardwired decision-making shortcuts that are influencing our decisions that were developed, you know, from an evolutionary perspective to help us get through the day. And we just rely on them so much. We default to them so often that we're not even aware. It's almost like breathing. We're not conscious of the fact that we're doing it, but we're doing it all the time.
So we could spend the whole episode going into this on many fronts, but I want to dig in specifically on what this means for behavioral science and marketing. So for someone who is out there, they're marketing, they're trying to deal with the world that is changing around us at such a crazy pace. They're trying to figure out what are they going to do and it's hard to get organic traffic and, you know, all these things. How should they be thinking about using behavioral science and marketing with what you're talking about? Like, how should they be tapping into that kind of instinct-based decision-making? And could you give us an example of what that looks like?
Sure. So, you know, so a lot of times in marketing, what do? We start with, why should my target do what I want them to do? And that's a smart place to start, right? Okay, I've got this product, I've got this service, and here are all the reasons why it makes sense for my target, my carefully selected target, to do what I want them to do. And then we kind of stop there. But what we also need to do is we need to say, well, why might they not want to do this, right? We've got all these great reasons, and yet we don't have 100% of the people doing what we want them to do, right? So why might somebody not want to do what we're asking them to do? And then as we start to identify those potential barriers, those things that hold us back, then we start to look at behavioral science. And we say, all right, what do we have in this, you know, behavioral science bag of tricks, like these proven decision-making shortcuts that we know people rely on, that we might be able to use in order to increase the likelihood that people do what we want them to do? And it's important to note, and probably now is a fine time to do it, that as we're applying behavioral science to marketing, it's not like it's a magic wand, right? It's not like we can make people do what we want them to do. We can't, right? People have free will, but we can make it more likely that they'll notice our message, that they'll understand our message, and that they'll feel the need to act on it now versus later. You know, and if we can manage those things as marketers, that's a really great thing. So as marketers, instead of stopping at, okay, here's why people need to do what we want them to do, and let's just get that message out there, we also need to think about, okay, why might they not? And what are some of the ways that we might be able to increase the likelihood that they do? So here's an example for you, because you asked for an example. We had a client that sold they were in the financial services industry. And so they worked with financial advisors, and they wanted those financial advisors to sell funds and retirement accounts and, you know, things like that, basically investments. And things were going well for a while. And then a group of these advisors just stopped selling my client's products. And so my client was like, oh, well, okay, let's try to reengage them. So they, you know, they called and they emailed and, you know, really tried to get hold of them and didn't have much success, right? So now a year has passed. A year has passed and these people just have completely stopped selling my client's products. So one would have to assume that they've either found another product, a vendor that they like better, another supplier that they like better, or maybe they're just out of the business, right? I mean, maybe they're selling other kinds of things. They're not interested in selling those funds anymore, but it's been a year. So they came to us and they said, you know, what can we do? We want to send them something. We want to send them something to, you know, to reactivate them. I said, all right, well, you've tried emailing, you've tried calling, but all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to tap into something called the reciprocity principle. And the way the reciprocity principle works is when you give somebody something, when you do them a favor, when you give them a gift, whether or not they asked for it, once they're the recipient of it, they feel obliged to return the favor, right? We don't like to feel like we owe people anything. We, you know, we like to feel like we're good people, nice people, civil people. And again, this is hardwired into us since the early days of humankind, because if you weren't reciprocal, if you didn't kind of do your share in the tribe or the clan, you'd get ostracized. And if you were kicked out of the clan or the tribe, you would not survive on your own, right? It just wasn't going to happen back then. So from a very early time, it's kind of hardwired into us that, you know, we need to reciprocate. We, you know, and so we feel this obligation. So we said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to send people a gift. So first we send them an email saying, watch your USPS mail because we've picked out this gift specifically for you and it's coming in the mail. And now in financial services, you can only spend so much. It's a regulated industry. So it's not like we could send them, you know, here's $100 or here's $1,000 or here's a trip to, you know, Hawaii. You know, we had to have a cap on what we could spend. But what we did is we sent them a personalized New Yorker cartoon. So it was this, you know, amusing cartoon that was really relevant to a financial planner. I think it was like a little kid going around the neighborhood and trying to sell his adult neighbor's life insurance or something. It was cute in context. And in the caption, it included their name. So mine would have Nancy in the caption. Chris, yours would say Chris. Sylvie, yours would say Sylvie, like right in the caption. And it was signed by the New Yorker artist. And we framed it. And we sent it to people. And we included a quick note that just said, hey, we've missed you, you know, from of course, the client. You know, we've missed you. Here's a few things that we've been up to since you've been away. Thought these might be useful to you as you continue to build out your practice. Client calls us and reports a $68 million incremental lift in revenue, right, that they track back to that campaign.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable, right? Would not have made that money. Now, you know, what happened? Right? I mean, these people didn't ask for the framed cartoon, but they got it. And so A, it put my client more top of mind, of course, right? Yep. But B, it triggered that reciprocity. It's like, you know, I should, you know, take the call when they call, or I should pick up the phone and call them. And more importantly, I should maybe start selling their products again. So $68 million in incremental.
That's
revenue.
Amazing. Yeah. And it's just that simple instinct to feel like we don't want to owe something to somebody else is kind of what it comes down to, right? So people, Absolutely. People got this. They're delighted. I mean, it's a very clever thing to send out.
I would be so jazzed to get a personalized.
Oh my gosh. You would be over the moon. That was you.
Yeah. New Yorker cartoon. That's the dream of dreams.
Well, it's very cool. And you know, you could see how it would be in their office or hanging on their wall or sitting on their desk, you know, so constant top of mind. And Chris, to your point, people felt like they didn't want to be obliged to owe. They wanted to return the favor, right? They didn't want to be in that owing position. And behavioral science research shows that sometimes, because of exactly what you said, we will reciprocate with even more than we need to, you know? So like if you took me out for dinner on my birthday and, you know, we went to, I don't know, Applebee's or something, right? You know, and then it's your birthday. And it's like, I got to take Chris out for his birthday because I, you know, like I've been waiting so I can return this debt. And there's no Applebee's nearby. So we end up going to a much nicer restaurant, right? You know, Capital Grill Steakhouse or something, you know?
That's what
I was thinking, me more than it cost you, but I don't care because I just want to get this, you know, checked off my list. I want to reciprocate. And so behavioral scientists have found that we sometimes will answer beyond what we really need to just so that we can do it. It's
I think this just happened to me like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That somebody gifted you something?
Someone gifted me something and I was really not expecting it. It was like a small thing, but I was meeting up with them to give career advice, someone who through some of the mentoring that I do. And they're like, hey, I was traveling and I got you these like cookies from Hawaii. And I just like thought I'd bring them to you. And I was like, what? Like, I was so shocked by this. And it was this tiny, tiny little thing. I didn't even eat the cookies. I gave them to my kids. But I felt this feeling of like, wow, this person has like gone above and beyond. So I made some intros and did a bunch of stuff. And like, I think I would have done that anyway. But it felt it was interesting
like more
because
urgent.
It felt like I really needed to do it. And I don't know, because I do. It's funny because I often ignore what people, at least people used to send free stuff to me at the office. I'm like, I don't even need this. Just like give this to somebody else. And then it doesn't work. But in this case, it was almost like, cause it was so small and it was so specific, it broke through to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very thoughtful and it was unexpected.
Super thoughtful.
And,
yeah.
You know, and like you said, you likely were going to help anyway, but you know, Sylvia said, maybe you did it a lot faster or maybe you did a little bit more. Maybe you would have made a couple of introductions, but you made three.
Well, I told other people about it. I like came up in conversation and I was like, you won't believe what this kid did. He gave me this. I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And if you said like, you know, all right, how do you decide whether or not to help people? You know, you probably wouldn't say, well, if they bring me cookies from Hawaii, I'm going to help them, right? You know,
yes,
you
exactly.
Say, no, I help people because, you know, it's the kind of person I am or because I want to give back or because,
yes,
you know,
sure.
I know this kid's father or something, you know what I mean? Or
because it seems irrational to help because of the cookies. Like when you put it like that, I sound like a crazy person. All you have to do is give me cookies. I'll help you out.
Right.
We're going to get all these cookies set up.
The true cookie monster is revealed.
Right, so we don't think the way we think we do. There it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, when do you think, I mean, obviously, I would imagine you would tell me you should always use these principles in everything that you do. But like, is there a time that it's better or worse to be kind of thinking about these instinctual level responses and how you incorporate them into your marketing?
Well, I mean, there are quite a few of them, right? Like we just talked about reciprocity. And I wouldn't say like always use reciprocity or always use any one particular one. But I do think that it makes sense, particularly as marketers, to keep in mind how people make decisions all the time, really. Like whatever campaign we're sending out. I mean, obviously, we want to be honest. We want to be ethical. We want to be authentic. You know, all of those things still hold. But the, you know, the missing element is just try to remember how people make decisions. It's not as logical and fact-based as we think. And that's true for B2B and B2C. You know, we might say, oh, well, certainly in B2C, it's, you know, not as logically based, but that's true in B2B as well. People don't make the decisions the way that we think they do. And as marketers, we really should keep that in mind. There might be times when we choose one behavioral science tactic over another. Or there might be times when we use more of them versus fewer of them, a little bit heavier, a little bit lighter, but it's important to keep in mind. But again, to do it ethically, responsibly, and authentic to who you are, that, you know, that's a way that's in keeping with your brand and your brand values.
Is there a line that like people shouldn't cross in marketing when they're trying to sell or persuade? Or, I mean, you've mentioned ethics and sort of like, yeah, where can you get carried away in a bad way?
Yeah, you know, you look at these tactics, you're like, oh, that's great. If I give someone something, they're more likely to do something for me. If I say there's only three of these left, they're more likely to make the buying decision now than if they think there's 300 of them left, right? They're, you know, so you're like, this is great. This is what I want to do. And the line for me is to just be honest, right? If you wouldn't say it to your spouse, to your friend, to your mother, you know, don't say it to your prospects, don't say it to your audience, right? We know that using behavioral science helps people get off the dime. It helps them, you know, make decisions faster, if you will, not delay them, because it's very easy to delay decisions. We're busy. But if you know, for example, that somebody is interested in something that you're selling, and you in fact are starting to run out and there's only three left, you're doing them a favor by saying there's only three left. If on the other hand, you know somebody is interested in what you're selling and you really want to move your product because you have 300 of them in the stock room, it might be tempting to say, hey, there's only three left, but you don't want to do it. You wouldn't say that to your friend. You wouldn't say it to your mother. Don't say it to your prospect, because even if you get that short-term win, once you're found out, the blowback is severe and you may never recover from it, right? So it's just not worth it. It's, you know, think about like email. When email first came out, it was like, spray and pray, right? We would just blanket everybody with email and, you know, maybe some of them would respond and that would be good. And hey, it was cheap, so why not? And then, you know, we as marketers, we began to realize not such a good idea, right? And now we're much more selective. We target, we're careful. We have people opt in. We let people unsubscribe because, you know, we know that that's the right thing to do. And it's the same thing with these behavioral science principles. They're incredibly useful, effective, powerful, but they do need to be used responsibly. And, you know, if you're not going to use them responsibly, just don't use them, right? So that's where the line is for me.
You talk a lot about decision defaults and cognitive shortcuts. What are your few of your favorite go-to triggers or nudges that reliably move people to act?
So one of them is really interesting. And I actually discovered this as I was writing my book, right? Using behavioral science and marketing. I was doing some research for the book and I kind of came upon this this principle called autonomy bias. And it's this idea that we all have this deep-seated, hardwired desire to exert some kind of control over ourselves and our environments. I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then, you know, I dug a little bit more and it's like, well, basically it means we don't like to be told what to do. We don't like to be forced into doing things. We like to feel like we're the ones who are making the call. And there was a bit of research that was done in a nursing home, right? A facility for older people. And what they did is some people were given a movie to watch every week and they had a plant in their room. And hey, that's pretty cool, right? I get a movie every week. I've got someone who's got this plant in my window and they come in and they care for it. Other people were given a choice of, you know, several different movies and they could choose the movie they wanted that week. And they were given a plant, put it on the windowsill, but they were the ones who had to kind of care for it. And when the researchers came back like a year later, half of the people who had been given the movie and given the plant that was taken care of were dead. And the people that still were allowed autonomy, that could choose which movie they wanted, that were told, hey, you're the one who's going to water, they were still alive. And the researchers were like blown away, right?
Wow.
And
so my God.
It was amazing, right? And so the researchers said that like this need for autonomy is really deep seated. And when you start to take it away from people, and it does track with some other research about, you know, people feeling happiest at jobs when they feel they have purpose, when they feel that they're making a meaningful contribution, right? You know, so one of my favorites, we're talking about marketing, we're not talking about keeping people alive, but one of my favorites
same difference.
Yeah, close enough, right? Yeah, right. You know, one of my favorite go-to tactics is the idea of autonomy bias, giving people choices, right? If people have some kind of a choice, they feel that, you know, they're in control, that they're the ones who are making the choice, so they've got some kind of autonomy. And a lot of times in marketing, we're so focused on a personalized recommendation. You know, we're going to do the work for you. We're going to make it easy for you. We're going to tell you exactly what it is you need. This is the one for you, Chris, and this is the one for you, Sylvie. And, you know, you're much better off as a marketer giving it, you know, like, three choices, saying, hey, Chris, here are three we've chosen for you. Sylvie, here are three that we think would be really great for you. And then I'm still making it easy for you. I'm not saying here's 300 or here's 30. But you're still making the choice. And then related to autonomy bias is the BYAF technique. BYAF, it stands for but you are free. And what behavioral scientists have found is you can tell someone what you want them to do. You can ask them to do it. And then if you follow that request with a phrase like, but you were free to choose, or the choice is yours, or it's up to you, you can on average double the likelihood people do what you want them to do. And you would say to yourself, Nancy, that makes no sense, right? It's counterintuitive. I've just sold my heart out. I've just gotten to my call to action. I want you to click that button. I want you to, you know, open my email or go to my website or put the product in the cart or whatever it is. Like I've got you right where I want you. And then I'm going to back off and say, but you know what? It's up to you. It's your choice. I mean, do it if you want, don't if you don't. But it's just the idea of reminding people that they're not being pushed into something, that they're coming to the decision of their own volition. It makes them that much more likely to do what you're asking them to do. So this idea of autonomy bias coupled with the BYAF technique, absolutely one of my favorites.
That's clever. You know, it's as you're talking about this, I can't stop myself from thinking about parenting. And it's this thing that it, you know, one of my kids is very stubborn. Well, I guess they both are, but one of them in particular is very stubborn. And what I've found is that I can't say something like, do you want to go to the park? They'll be like, no. But if I say, do you want to go to this park with the jungle gym or do you want to go to this park with the other thing? Then, you know, both options are going to the park, but they have some agency. That often is the difference between getting them to take action. Because I feel that I'm constantly marketing my children to get them to do things.
You know, you're not the first one who's come to me with an example like that, you know, and it's so true. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about using behavioral science and marketing, but the truth is that at the foundational level, this is how people behave. So it's not just when they're responding to marketing messages, but it's just how people behave. And, you know, no better example than a child. Right. And it's like so perfect. You know, it's not, do you want to do this? Because, the answer could be no. But which of these two do you want? It's like perfect. You know,
I mean, there's, and they're both doing the thing.
Right. I mean, there, if you think about it, there is a third option, which is I want neither. But we rarely go there. We rarely go there, which is why choices are so powerful. You know, it does activate that that autonomy bias that we have. Similar to that, there's a magic phrase that I recommend to my clients. And it's what you said just reminded me, because instead of saying, you know, do you want to do this? Or how do you feel about this? Or, you know, do you like this? When you phrase a question that way, you know, you're going to get an honest answer, but you may not want to hear the answer. I don't like that. No, I don't want to try this. No, I don't want to do this, you know. But if instead you phrase your request is, would you be willing to, you're much more likely to get a yes response. And the reason is, do you like, you know, this? Do you want this? That's all about personal preference. But would you be willing to consider this? Would you be willing to try this? That's about character. It's about who you are as a person. Mm. And we all like to be thought of as someone who's, you know, reasonable, who's, you know, clear-headed and calm and willing to entertain someone else's opinion or request. And it may not work as well for little children.
I'll try it. That's all I'm thinking. I'm sitting here like, okay, I'm going to try this.
But try it, you know, with your spouse, with your colleagues, you know. It can be very, very powerful because it's like, yes, I would be willing to do that, you know, as opposed to, no, I don't want to do that. Like, that's crazy. Yeah.
It's so fun because it's words, really. It's semantics. But it does evoke a totally different feeling. Do you like versus would you be willing?
And it's like, how much agency do you have, right? It's like, do you still have agency to make a choice? Or are you giving me an option? Are you forcing me to do something? And to your point, like, especially, I mean, I think everybody has this in them. Some of us maybe have it more than others. Where they feel like they have to do their own thing. But I think it's an interesting example of how this very small tweak can have a huge impact on the actions that people take.
Yeah. You know, I grew up as a copywriter and I always like to say words matter and they do. I mean, sometimes it's the difference between one word and another. Jay Schwedelson, who does a lot of work with email, he owns World Data, and he found that complimentary and free in a subject line, they both mean the same thing, right? Free will get you twice as many opens as complimentary. Yeah. You know, I mean, and gone are the days when free will relegate you to the spam, you know, filters. Now it's like free gets through, but the two mean the same thing. And when you think about it, you can get away with a lot fewer characters using the word free, right? So it's not going to make you a subject line too long, but you get twice as many opens. So the difference between one word or another, one phrase or another, do you want, would you be willing, free, complimentary, really, words matter. And sometimes we think if we're just accurate, if our information is correct, if we get it out on time, if there are no typos, we're good. But it's worth taking a little extra time and deciding, you know, about word choice and really, you know, trying to optimize your message to make it more likely people are going to respond.
Yeah. Speaking of free, I'm curious about the behavioral science behind deals. Like, is that still a powerful persuasion kind of go-to?
Like, you mean like a sale?
A sale. Something? Like, you're getting X percentage off, you're getting a bundle, you're getting, is like that. I feel like I see it all the time in B2B. I see it in B2C. What's happening behind there? Is it still relevant today? Has that card been overplayed?
It's a great question. In fact, I was just part of some research done by Intuit MailChimp, and they found that, I might have the number wrong, but something like 23% of people are feeling like just overwhelmed because there are too many sales. It's like they're just, you know, particularly during, you know, holiday periods where they're just like bombarded with these messages, and it just feels like it's just too much, you know? But that said, of course, yes, we, you know, generally speaking, we all like to get a deal. The thing that, you know, we hate perhaps more than anything is paying more for something that the next guy paid less for, right? That feels like a loss to us because we spent more on it than we could have. So, you know, we all like to feel special. And if you have a deal that's not available to everyone, but it's available to a certain group of people, or it's available to a particular person because of something that they themselves did, they subscribed to your newsletter, they made a purchase, you know, last month, whatever it is, you know, we all like to feel special. We all like to feel like we're getting something that not everyone else can get. So exclusivity is good. We don't like to overpay. You know, that's the idea of loss aversion, right? I'm spending more than I need to, you know, which is why sales can be good. But for brands to rely on a steady diet of just sales, 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 well, first of all, no brand wants to, right? Because that's a game you can't win. And, you know, and second of all, it turns out that it's not really the best way to develop that relationship with your audience and to, you know, establish your worth and the reason why people would return to you again and again. So sales, deals, sometimes, absolutely, keep them as part of the mix. Used only or exclusively, probably not so great.
Yeah. I like a deal, but yeah, I do feel like deal barraged.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is if someone always has a deal, people start to get skeptical and they wonder, you know, it's like, believe them, or do they just jack the price up in order to give me a discount? You know, and so that starts to erode the brand trust too. You know, if somebody is always going out of business and they have been for the last 2 years with this great going out of business sale, you're like, really? I think you're in business. You know,
does Wistia do deals?
We do a discount if you sign up annually.
Okay,
that's the nice one. That's the one place that really happens.
Yeah.
Which is helpful, and you know, it's transparent. People understand what it is.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's the reason why. It's like, I'm going to give you a discount if you do this, and it's like, okay, that makes sense. You're going to get something. I'm going to get something. You know, and simply having a reason why and stating what the reason why is often increases compliance, increases the likelihood people do what you're asking them to do.
We've never done like a Black Friday deal or something like that. We always felt like we're trying to make better products, so we're willing to have them cost more. And they're not a lot more, but like slightly more than some of the other options are about the same. And so discounting it felt like it was cheapening the brand. So we mostly don't do that.
That, you know, it's an interesting point. Can I just jump in here? There's something called the labor illusion. And it's this idea that, you know, if you have a product or a service that people aren't super, super familiar with, like video production, like not everyone knows how to really do that or knows the ins and outs or something. What they do is they'll look, what humans will do, what people will do is we'll look at the time or effort that goes into developing something as a proxy for its quality. So you're saying like, you know, you've got a particularly good one, and so you don't want to discount it because that would cheapen it. The other thing you can do is you can explain why it's particularly good, why it's different than everyone else's, the effort that went into it, which helps justify the higher
price.
Exactly. You know?
If you have no differentiation and your thing is to be cheaper, you can take that approach, but then there is always only one cheapest. So it's kind of a race to be the cheapest, right? And then you're getting a buyer who that's their most important criteria versus buying the thing that's going to like lift their business the most or whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's an interesting thing because it's like the balance of all of this. Like, how do you fit in the behavioral science? How do you fit in the instinct with the brand, with the product, with the market, and use it in the right places? Even just thinking about your reciprocity kind of example, we used to give free t-shirts to people a lot, like a huge amount as a surprise.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I had so many people tell me how much they love the shirts. And, you know, it was at a time when most people were giving away crappy t-shirts and ours were like the highest end you could get. So they were super soft. And so people would tell me like, well, I always wear this to bed or I wear it to the gym and I just love it so much. And it was like, well, then I think it's working. And it kind of built up this brand. It was one of the first things we did, I think, that really built up the brand. And it's a very, very simple thing. It got out of control at one point because you could just go to this special what part of the website. We were sending out like tens of thousands of shirts like at one point. We're like, okay, this has gone a bit far. But it was great for a long time.
Well, and the fact that it was like a really nice, high quality, soft one, you know, that just reflects on your brand. Because if the promotional t-shirt you're giving away is that good, you know, then your services must be good too, right?
Exactly.
Like the product I'm going to get from you is going to be similar quality. That's nice. And you know, these are kind of the mental leaps that people make, right?
Yeah. And I think we all make those leaps, and it's just, it's hard to realize we're doing it. Like, back to your point in the first place, like, I think I'm being nice and friendly. And if you ask me why, I'd be like, it's the best version of this. You know, this guy's really great, but actually gave me cookies. And that's might've been enough because it was done in the right way.
Not that the guy wasn't great. I mean, the two,
he is great. You know, guy. Great, yeah, yeah. Guy.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Yes. Exactly. They're not mutually exclusive.
Do you think it's, is it harder to incorporate behavioral science into B2B marketing? Because like you were just talking about, you know, the brand love, brand affinity, that feels way easier to tap into with B2C. Is it?
I think when people hear about behavioral science, yeah, very often, you know, the first things they think of are the B2C instances, because it just seems to, I don't know, make more sense, I guess, right? And B2B, you know, we all think in B2B, people make decisions for the good of the company. They're very rational and logical about these decisions. They weigh the pros and cons. They do the cost-benefit analysis. It's all very considered. And it's not that that's not true, but there is another component to it, right? Because whether it's B2B or B2C, what's the one constant? You're dealing with people, right? And
yeah,
people are people, whether they're at home or at work, right? The, you know, the financial services example I gave you with the reciprocity, the framed New Yorker cartoon, that was a B2B example, right? You know, so, but is it harder to get people to think in these terms when they're doing marketing for B2B? Yes, because our default is to go, oh, this is B2B, you know, much more cut and dry, you know, much more serious, not as much room for, you know, personal opinion, not as much room for emotion or for, you know, other considerations. And again, it's not that we're not trying to make the best decision for the company, but, you know, if I'm looking at some products and I've got a few different ones and one of them looks like it could be really good for my company, but it's going to be really hard for me to push it through and to get the, you know, the necessary yeses from the buying committee, I might just walk away from it and choose the one that's almost as good, but easier for me to get through. Or if there's another product that I think is terrific, but I think, oh my God, onboarding is going to be a nightmare. I'm never going to see my, you know, my spouse and kids for the next, you know, 3 months because I'm going to be stuck at the office. I might skip over that and find one that's, you know, good enough and lets me get home for dinner on time, right? You know, human emotion and human decision-making factors in even in B2B. You know, we're influenced, right? Like take something like social proof. You know, if a bunch of people are doing something, we think, well, I want to do it too. Same thing happens in B2B. If a lot of people are buying, you know, this vendor's stuff, if a lot of people are signing up for this particular vendor's service, that does influence me. And that's a, you know, it's a B2B situation.
Yeah. I also look at it in a very similar way, and that you don't even know if the B2B product is going to deliver, right? Like you never know. You're being sold this idea, but it's going to have to be implemented properly. It's going to have to be used properly. You have people who know what they're doing. So you are actually taking a risk every single time. Like it is not clear cut. And I think about that, especially for different features on different plans. You don't know what you don't have. You don't know how much it's going to help you. And so there is, of course, back to your example, like there's a lot of people making instinct-based decisions. And I would bet a lot of the decision makers who are not the users of the product always in B2B, they are totally influenced by the brand, what they see people talking about on social, the, you know, the advertisements and the sports that they watch and all that kind of stuff. So when someone does come and say, hey, it's these two, it's like, well, I know this one feels like a safe bet. And they probably can't tell you why, but it is, I think it's why we see a lot of the biggest B2B companies in the world are advertising all the time. And they do these ads that also feel like funny and like they don't explain what their product is, because that's not the point. The whole point is that you just have some familiarity with them, some positive association such that later when they're making that decision, feels easy, feels like instinct driven.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, it's like that, if something feels familiar, we're more likely to believe that it's true. You know, I've heard of them. They must be good, right? Like they sprang to mind quickly. And if it was easy for me to recall, well, then that, you know, that feels right. And if something
they're safe
right,
bets.
It must be right.
I think about like people used to talk about IBM as like the safe bet, right? And what's happened is that the safe bet has changed. And I wonder if you agree with this. To me, it seems like the speed that B2B companies can be created and have a brand today is much faster than it used to be. And so this, like today, using a bunch of AI stuff, OpenAI, pretty safe bet, right? Like, it's like, well, if I want you to like an LLM and I see OpenAI, I might have understood that, where there might be some other one that's way better I've never heard of. And if it's a risk, it's like, which one are you going to take? And so it's like, oh, OpenAI is safe. And I think that's something that's like, does seem like it's happening faster, is that the safe bet is shifting. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about it, but I, as you explained it, I'm like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, there's something called the mirror exposure effect, which is the more often we hear something, the more often we're exposed to it, the more likely we are to believe it. And it's easier these days to get our message out there faster and more frequently than it used to be. And so as a result, we can shift that perception so that it's a, you know, a relatively new product, company, service, startup starts to feel a lot more familiar than, you know, than it would have, you know, back in the, you know, the days of IBM, Big Blue, right? When it took a long time to kind of build that brand and build that brand preference. It can be done more quickly now. And as a result, you can start to shift that preference. You know, it doesn't feel scary because, as you said, Chris, it is all about feeling like this is a safe choice, feeling like, well, all right, I can't know for sure, but nobody's going to point at me and go, I can't believe you made that decision when, you know, it's a product or a company that we've all heard of, right? So how could that be the wrong decision? So it feels
safe. Exactly. Yeah, it's confusing. I mean, I don't know. Have either of you heard of Cursor?
No.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Cursor is like, I think maybe now the fastest growing SaaS thing ever, maybe. It's up there. And it's a code editor that has LLMs built in, and you chat with it. So you, if you've heard vibe coding, you're like, oh, like make a red website that has all my favorite like F1 cars. Let me like interact with them. And you chat that, and then it builds the code. And then you just keep chatting back and forth. But I feel like it's become that thing where I see it every day. I see it all the time. It seems like the default. It seems crazy not to use it. Now, is it actually how this stuff is going to end up and going to be? I don't know. But like, I see it so much that it certainly feels like that in this moment.
It feels crazy not to use it. You know, I mean, line, you just summed it up. It's like, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't I?
I think it's also interesting if you're an incumbent, because if you're not playing this game also, then you're leaving your flank open, right, that somebody else can play this game. And so this feels like to me at this point, it's like brand isn't me to be. We're all human beings. Like, you have to admit it, or you're just going to, it's going to be very hard to compete.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, when you bring up a good point with incumbents, you know, you want to keep the people you have because you don't want them picked off by your competition. So then, you know, you want to keep reminding them of what they've got. There's something behavioral scientists refer to as the endowment effect. And it's this idea that if there's something that we want, well, obviously we value it. That's why we want to get it. But once it becomes ours, we overvalue it, right? We place greater value on things that are ours, that these become worth more to us. So what we need to do to retain our customers, to keep our, you know, our customer base where it is to remind them of what they're getting from us, remind them of the smart choice they made and all the goodwill they've built up. And, you know, sometimes the physical things, listen, you've got this database with us, you've got your preferences saved with us, like whatever it is, but just remind people of what they have to kind of, you know, insulate them from those competitor threats that are out there. Because, you know, you want to make it seem like the grass is definitely greener where I am and then not over there. Right.
Yeah.
Isn't that also the effect where you can get more word of mouth from new customers because they've just made a decision? And so they're like, they want to see that they're like, oh, I'm getting value from this, where, you know, a few years in, they take it for granted unless you remind them. And so they're like, oh, this thing's good, but they're not like talking about it as much. It's like not top of mind, even though they might be using it every day.
Yeah. I mean, there's that like that honeymoon period where, you know, somebody first makes a decision and then they're A, more likely to talk about it, and B, the reason they're more likely to talk about it is even though they made the decision, they're still kind of double checking to make sure to confirm right, that they made the right decision.
Am I really? Yeah. Was this really right? I can't tell.
You know. And so you want to reassure yourself that you did make the right decision. And so you're looking for points of confirmation, right, to confirm that you made the right decision. And you're going to engage with that kind of material, right, that kind of information. You're going to talk to people about it because it just makes you feel better that, I made the right call here.
So interesting.
It's super interesting. When you realize that all this stuff is impacting you all the time and you're doing things that are impacting others, it's a very funny spot.
And just like how many like juncture points there are to make that customer an evangelist for your product. Like, if it happens in the honeymoon phase, at what point, like down the road, can we kind of like recreate that feeling and make them, yeah, just feel like, yep, this is a great product. I know exactly why I have it, and I'm going to tell everybody else about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of asking, you know, with a little bit of a prompt or a request, people will be like, oh yeah, sure. I'll, you know, I can refer you or I can give you a testimonial. Sometimes it's surprising people, you know, they've been a long-term customer and they weren't expecting something from you and boom, you surprise them. And that gets them to chat about it, you know, whether it's a little gift or an upgrade or just a special shout out or an introduction or, you know, just something that they weren't expecting. And that kind of activates it. And the next thing you know, you're back to being top of mind with them and more likely to be talked about. But Sylvia, you raise a good point. You know, sometimes in business, we're so focused on acquisition, we give retention short shrift. And we really should be thinking about it because it's easier to keep a customer than it is to win a new one. And, you know, so it's worth thinking a little bit about retention and retention strategies and just things we can do to our existing customer base to A, keep them happy and B, you know, get the maximum return from having them as customers.
So I have two more questions I want to make sure we get through before you leave. The first one is a lot of marketers today are being asked to do more with less. Right. Like we've seen this in our research, especially with video, but in general, right? Like we're basically saying like, hey, we need to use more video everywhere. We need to market way more. We have a smaller team. Our budget's staying the same. So for people who are in that spot, they have a limited time or budget. What is the lowest lift behavioral tactic that you think could make the biggest difference for them?
Wow. Okay. That's a good question. I've never been asked that before. And I've been asked, you know, similar questions like, well, you know, if you had to recommend one, you know, what is it, you know, which one technique do you recommend? What's your one go-to? And the truth is it really does depend on the particular situation, right? The context, you know, what is it you're selling? Who are you selling to? What is their mindset? What do they think or not think about you? So it's hard to answer, but I'm going to try. So
nice.
I think.
Would you be willing to give it a try?
I think loss aversion might be maybe one of the most powerful tactics that we can use because people are twice as motivated to avoid the pain of loss as they are to achieve the pleasure of gain. So again, coming back to marketing, you know, we're all about the benefits, the gains, the advantages. You know, here's all the wonderful things that will happen if you just sign up for my service. If you just, you know, choose me as your partner. And what we need to do is, you know, we need to kind of cross over and think about, well, all right, you know, I'll gain a lot if I do that. But if what's going to motivate me more is what I'm going to lose, how can I phrase this or frame this in terms of loss aversion? You know, there was a study that was done where the researchers were talking about, I think, home insulation. And they said, you know, you could save 50 cents a day if you insulate your home. Or other people, they told, you know, you're going to lose 50 cents a day if you don't insulate your home. And they got like twice as many people to go for the home insulation when they were told they were going to lose it. So if we're looking at maybe like one easy technique that we can use, it's, you know, and I'm not saying walk away from the benefits, but it's balancing the benefits with some loss aversion. You know, it's like, here's all the great stuff you can get. And if you don't act now, here's how that might, you know, be a problem for you. Here's what you're going to lose out. You know, here's the problem you may encounter. Here's the pain you may find yourself in. So I would say look for some opportunities to inject some loss aversion because people are twice as motivated to avoid the pain of loss as they are to achieve the pleasure of gain.
Yeah, it was hard for me not to think about my own things I have coming up that I was like more worried about the downside than the upside. So definitely strikes a chord with me. Where do you think that behavioral science in marketing is going next, especially with what's happened with AI?
Yeah. No conversation is complete without those.
No, we have to have the final question be AI. What kind of people would we be? I mean, come on.
So I think there's a couple of interesting things going on. I think that the combination of artificial intelligence and innate intelligence, if you will, behavioral science, is going to be incredibly powerful. And so the AI, at a minimum, at least right now, is going to allow us to crunch numbers faster, you know, evaluate data more quickly, you know, just kind of allow us access to information that used to take way longer to get to. And and based on that information, we'll know how to better segment people, we'll know how to better find people, we'll know kind of where they are in their, you know, in the buying cycle. And then when we have all of that data, which now we've gotten so much faster and easier, then we can apply the behavioral science so that we know exactly what message to kind of surgically deploy against which particular segment, you know, it down to like even a one-to-one kind of a messaging strategy. So the behavioral science, that's going to be the thing that always allows us to best create a message, customize a message, infuse it with the words and the phrases and the frames that are going to be most likely noticed, understood, and responded to. And the AI is going to help us do that on an exponential level. We're going to be able to do it cheaper, we're going to be able to do it faster, and we're going to be able to do it more effectively. And I think that's where that marriage is currently happening and heading us in that direction.
It seems like working to incorporate this into the actual human communications that you do have with your customers is going to be more important, right? You're like, you're leaving more to chance in a world where, you know, it's harder to get web traffic. People will do more research without you. By the time they show up, I would imagine this is going to, we're going to have to expect more from our websites and like higher conversion rates, but also like from our sales team, from our support team, from our success teams, right? Training them and making sure that the experience that they're creating is so elevated to combat the fact that it's even harder to find people.
So, yeah, I mean, that is a good point. It's harder to find people. It's harder to win the business. And so in order to kind of justify in the prospect's mind choosing us, and then in order to retain them, we do have to be operating at a higher level. We should be thinking about where we can add behavioral science into our communications, into our customer experience, in order to, you know, make it more likely people choose us and stay with us. No question.
I was just going to ask if there were any downsides. Any downsides to behavioral science and AI joining forces?
You know, there are always downsides to to introducing AI into the equation. We need proper oversight. We need to look at the data set that the AI has been trained on. We need to ferret out biases. You know, so there are always things we need to watch for. We need to watch for hallucinations. And not just in marketing. I mean, we've got attorneys who are running into trouble because they're citing cases that don't exist.
We have healthcare
professionals who are running into trouble because the artificial intelligence encouraged somebody to self-harm when they were supposed to be, you know, giving them therapy, right? Yeah. So we always have to be aware of what we're using and the potential pitfalls, and we want to set up the guardrails and make sure that that we're keeping an eye on things and that we're not just putting things on autopilot with no human intervention.
Yeah, it seems like the QA, quality assurance, is about to be much more important than it's been. And I feel like there's going to be like this renaissance of people figuring out how to do it well in this world. Because, you know, let's just pick one example, but I'll pick one from Wistia. So Wistia, we're known for our support. If you go look us up on all the review sites, like our support's amazing. We have an incredible team. Not only do we get back to you quickly, we solve problems that people would be surprised that we would solve. Like, we go above and beyond. Now, should we use AI in our support? We're testing it. We're trying it. And we only work certain hours. And so it's like we're trying these other hours and stuff. But if we end up making a worse experience, it's not just that people are getting slower response rates. You're actually negatively impacting the brand. Mm-hmm. And if you can't control what those things are saying, it could possibly really hurt us, right? It could actually really hurt the word of mouth we get by having great, fantastic human support. So how do you incorporate this in the right ways and not the wrong ways is becoming very, very important. You don't want to feel behind if everyone around you feels like they're going so quickly. I don't want to be the last one at the party, but also I don't want to get to the wrong party and then ruin everything. So it's a very interesting challenge and it's exciting, but it's also just, I don't know. I just go back to like every interaction with the human is going to be much more important. The copy we write on our website is going to be much more important. The emails we send are going to be much more important. Having anyone's contact information is going to be harder. So they all become instantly more important and more of exactly the type of approach you take to improve how we connect with people.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, we've got this like movement towards AI in like just exponential terms. And as a result, it just makes the human aspect that much more important. And it's just a question of how and where to insert it properly, you know, because as you said, we have to do this. We have to keep moving on. We don't want to be the last one to the party, but we don't want, as you said, go to the wrong party either. You know, it's got to be done. It's got to be done properly.
Exactly. Nancy, thank you so much for being here with us today. This is amazing.
Thank you for having me. I totally enjoyed chatting with you both. It was an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Where's the best place that people can connect with you and learn more?
Sure. So I'm the co-founder of HPT Marketing, and you can find me on the socials, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Threads. And my book, Using Behavioral Science and Marketing, Drive Customer Action and Loyalty by Prompting Instinctive Responses, is available online, you know, at Amazon, at KoganPage.com, the publisher, Barnes & Noble, just about anywhere. So, would love to hear from anyone. You know, drop me a line on email or connect with me on social, and would love to continue the conversation with your audience.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
She's so great.
Nancy is amazing. And yeah, behavioral science really gets me loud, gets me fired up.
I noticed that you're jumping in. You're thinking you like this.
It's just, I love thinking about why we do the things we do. And especially when it comes to marketing and what motivates somebody to buy or click or read. And that's going to become that much more important with AI.
Yeah, the instincts basically are going to become more important. Our instincts as marketers and also our instincts as buyers, right? So what do we feel? Is this giving me what I need? Is it confusing? Do I understand it? Do I have agency to make the decisions I want to make when I'm buying a product, when I'm using something new? Yeah, and I find it very interesting. And I thought there was another point that really jumped out to me in there, which is if you personalize something too much,
yes,
then people don't really like that. They still want to have the choice.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like we get this pitch all the time. Hey, if you just personalize this perfectly, then it'll work. But also, if it's AI personalizing it, then you'll know that it wasn't a human being doing the work. And if that's not exactly what you want, it's almost like, you don't know. And so it can set you off in the other direction.
Yeah, that made me think, I don't know why, of prefix menus. Oh. Where really successful ones are like, you get the choice of like fish or red meat or pasta. And really shitty ones are like, this is what you're getting.
Yeah. That's a really
cool
example. I like
to choose within the
guardrails.
Because
you're basically signed up. Like, I want to try the five things, the six things that you think I should have, but I still do have a choice.
Yes.
Yes. It's very interesting.
And why, like, I mean, I love diners, but diner menus, they cripple me. Too much choice.
What do you do? What's your move?
I usually just go for breakfast. So it's either just breakfast, eggs, home fries, bacon, or sausage.
And do you, like, what about if someone else orders the same thing? Is that fine or do you care?
You know, that's a good question. Yeah, then I start second guessing.
You get something else. It's got to be different.
A BLT is also a classic order for me at a diner.
So breakfast, if someone else orders the breakfast, you want BLT.
Yeah.
Interesting.
What about you?
I mean, I love an omelet.
Omelets are great.
But my ideal state is something like, oh, I'll have an omelet, I'll have some other stuff. And then should we get French toast for the table or like pancakes?
Yeah, that's a nice move.
That's how I get both.
A sweet for the table.
A little sweet, a little touch of sweetness for the table.
Yeah.
Yes.
Best of both worlds.
Yes. And there's coffee just down the hatch.
Yeah.
I don't know why we're going so deep down this diner talk, but someone out there can probably analyze this and tell us.
Yeah. There's behavioral science behind it. Yes.
Yes. Nancy will tell us why those are.
We're hungry. I think we're hungry.
I am hungry. Are you hungry?
I'm hungry. Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, I'm hungry for another episode and you might be too. So that'll be coming out in the next 2 weeks. And don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you consume the show. And of course, you can always email us at talkingtoloud@wiss.com with suggestions of guests, ideas, feedback. We love it all. And I think that is it until... What did I forget?
That's it.
Oh, that's it. Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye. Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubow, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.